I want to talk about the student revolt of recent years and get you thinking about certain aspects of it that I don't think have been given enough attention. What I have to say this morning is not is to be reflected on, not simply believed or not simply rejected. I want to go into an alternative explanation of what's happening on our college campuses today and why it may be happening, and it's related to what I was talking about yesterday. By the student revolt, I mean the phenomena on college campuses in recent years with which you're all somewhat familiar. Sit-ins, teach-ins, break-ins, you know, there are all kinds of degrees of these things. Picketing, indignant editorials against the establishment or against all kinds of establishments. Demands for a student voice in or even control over dormitory regulations, curriculum, grading, new building construction. There are all sorts of demands. Organized protests against the Vietnam War, including demonstrations from silent through violent. Harassing of corporate recruiters. Organized demands on the campus for social and economic justice. Picketing of segregated business establishments, shutting down Columbia University because of its alleged imperialism over against Harlem. All of these are what I mean by the student revolt. Well, what's happening here? The standard explanation is that the student today is a new breed of cat. He is involved. He's no longer content to be treated as a child or a ward of the state. He is no longer willing to enjoy the benefits of the great society without any responsibilities. Today's student is idealistic. The dirtiest word in his vocabulary is apathy. McLuhan says, electric technology has done all of this, television and so forth. Electric technology has replaced the fragmented man, the specialist, with the integral man, who demands a role. Students are no longer willing to be just students. They want to be total people involved in the problems of the society. Well, this is, as I say, the kind of a standard explanation. There's a great weakness in that explanation. It is the fact that a great majority of the students are not involved, except in fraternity beer parties. And I would even suspect, though I have no evidence on it, that the students who are involved in these protest movements watch less TV than those who sit home in the fraternity drinking beer. But anyway, there's supposedly been a kind of a change in the temperament and character of today's student. He's just different. Well, now, students, you know, have always protested. That's nothing new. I remember we griped about everything, meals, the regulations, stupid administration, all that. What's new, of course, is that recently students have systematically and openly broken the rules of the state or the university in the process of protesting. That's what's new. I mean, we used to break the rules, too, but we snuck around and did it. Today, you break the rules and you announce that you're breaking the rules. I would suggest that there's another kind of explanation. It really has various parts, and maybe it isn't one single explanation at all. But there is today in our country a different attitude toward law that has grown up, especially in the last few years, one that has been fostered in large part by the events of the civil rights movement. We can get into that if you want to, but most simply I would say that the civil rights movement involving disobedience to law was regarded by so many Americans, by some kind of consensus, as just and proper and appropriate and really the only way of dealing with this massive inequity of segregation and discrimination, that we tolerated it. We said, well, that's sort of lawful unlawfulness. And a lot of people sort of picked that up and said, well, if there is such a thing as lawful unlawfulness, which involves kind of, you know, doing what is right no matter what the law says, well, then why can't I do what is right no matter what the law says? So that if the university is making co-eds come in at 11 o'clock at night on Friday night, and that's unjust and contrary to the basic rights of man, I am justified in blowing up the administration building in protest. Now, I've taken a silly example. I think this may be a part of what's happening. Something else, though, I think that has been happening is a turning away from the traditions of democracy and liberalism, or what I call the liberal democratic tradition, a turning away from this by many customary supporters of it. A third thing is a decline of respect for rationality in the historic sense. This is definitely what I was talking about yesterday. That we are coming almost to accept the official view that data plus emotion are fit substitutes for reasoning problems through. And a fourth part of this explanation, I'd simply call it the revolt of the mass man, who does not understand and appreciate the sources of his own life. Because we don't have to worry about food, shelter, and the sustenance of life, because we don't have to worry about it, these things will be provided for us in any event. We can go out and protest, and in the process of protesting, we can even destroy that which gives us life. Well, I want to, you see, I'm saying there are two kinds of explanation. The one just says youth is involved today. There's a new morality, a new mentality. And this is a kind of a hopeful explanation. It says the new generation, they're better people than we were. And that's why we've got all these protests. So don't get too frightened about it. It's a good thing. It's a grand new moral generation that is rising. I don't want to say there's no truth in this, but I do want to suggest that the other kind of explanation deserves some consideration. And I would simply call it, summarize it as a kind of a revolt of the masses, because the way José Ortega y Gasset uses that phrase, revolt of the masses, it embraces most of the other things I was talking about. I want to try to suggest why I think this is the case today and what it really means. And I would suggest that the problem is seen as really a momentous one when we recognize that this revolt of the masses, whatever it means, I won't try to indicate what it means, has reached even into the universities. And this indicates that we are in very grave trouble indeed. You see, universities are committed to a process. That process is dialogue. A university is committed to no conclusions. Now, if somebody sets up a university in order to prove that, you know, in order to defend the view that, in order to defend any conclusion, we sneer and we say, well, it's not a real university. As if you set up a university there, they're growing up around the country, in order to defend the principles of free enterprise, there are some small schools that are being established by moneyed people, I think most of them are from Texas, which are dedicated to the economics of Ludwig von Mises. And of course, you don't really have complete freedom to pursue the truth as you see it, because you've got to finally come in line with the economics of Ludwig von Mises. Well, we say these aren't really universities, or Bible colleges, we say. If a school says, we'll allow everyone to pursue the truth as long as he remains faithful to the interpretation of Holy Scripture, we say, I don't think that's really a university.
When you say the revolt has gotten into the university, do you mean the faculty and administration, or do you mean the students?
Oh, primarily the students, but what is, I think, even more frightening is that the teaching assistants and many of the instructors and assistant professors are participating in it too. And this is the most alarming thing. But I want to argue that it isn't only the revolters that ought to make us alarmed. It is the monumental apathy on the part of others, which I think reflects the same underlying situation, that ought to alarm us. Well, all right, anyway, I hope you agree with me that a university is basically committed to a process. That process is dialogue. The people for whom the university primarily exists are its inquirers. And those inquirers are principally faculty and students. And they are committed, it seems to me. But if you want to call yourself a member of a university faculty or a university student, you're saying, I am committed to certain values. Put them on the board. What Swinowski calls the passion for truth, or the habit of truth. I mean, universities do this, don't they? The University of Chicago's motto is Veritas liberabit vos. Truth shall make you free. You know, truth, that's all we're interested in, truth. Now, you say that's rhetoric, but it's more than rhetoric. If somebody tries to suppress the truth, if someone tries to, well, what's the greatest sin that a university faculty member can commit? It's to cook his results, to suppress the evidence. That is the sin. You know, you can cheat on your wife, but don't you lie in your professional articles. Because there's a passion for truth. Bernowski calls it, I think using the image of a monk who puts on a habit, the habit of truth. Now this presupposes, you notice, that there is a distinction between truth and error, and that men are, in some sense, capable of making that distinction. Otherwise, it's silly to say we're pursuing the truth. The second value to which universities, by its very nature, to be committed, is tolerance of dissent. Even the welcoming of dissent. A university welcomes dissent because dissent is essential for free and successful inquiry. If nobody is quarreling, you know, if you publish your paper and everybody says, fine paper, applaud, 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 there is much more danger that you will have made many mistakes and overlooked many, many considerations that might have forced you to change your conclusion. So dissent is welcomed in a university. This is a value to which I think a university, by its very nature, has to be committed. Not just tolerance, indeed, the welcoming, the invitation of dissent. And thirdly, you might call it a respect for colleagues. Now, colleague here means any other inquirer, searcher after truth. A respect for each participant in the quest for truth. That really goes with this. You've got to, you see, if somebody wants to question your results, you've got to respect him. You cannot say, if you publish a paper proving that something or the other happens, and somebody says, I question those results, I was not able to repeat them in my laboratory, you are not allowed to say, oh, you're a fink, or you're from, or you're a Swede, or, you know, ad hominem arguments are not allowed. Everybody who wants to question your results is respected as another inquirer until he just proves that he's not to be taken seriously. Now, I'm not saying that we are, university people are this way. This is the value to which we are committed. We do not behave this nobly. But when we fail to behave this nobly, we know that we are sinning, that we are violating the creed of the university. Okay, today, this is the creed of the university. Today we're no longer so sure that there's a real distinction between truth and error. On the university campus, I so often hear this statement, this question, but doesn't everything finally depend on your personal point of view? You know, and you hear it's the blurring. Well, or if there is a distinction between truth and error, we're no longer sure that human beings are capable of making the distinction. We say, well, gee, everybody sees what he wants to see, doesn't he? You know, I mean, sure, you're impressed by that evidence because that's what you want to see. Well, in such a situation, if we kind of suspect that we can't find the difference between truth and error, can we really have a passion for truth? Then the guy who says, I have a passion for truth, we say, he's kind of hung up, you know. He thinks he's a truth seeker, you know. Actually, all he's doing is advancing the cause of his department. You know? I mean, we drift from this noble ideal to a kind of departmental empire building. Moreover, we do not welcome dissent. Sometimes we don't even tolerate it, because dissent cannot contribute to the discovery of truth. There is no truth. Who knows what it is, you know? I mean, if you criticize my article, what you're doing is interfering with the progress of my scholarly career. I publish an article not to advance the truth, but in order to get an article published, which I can then tell the dean about and get promoted. Dissent is noise. Dissent is inconvenience. It's inefficiency. Moreover, we don't really respect our colleagues, our fellow citizens, or co-members of the community. I mean, why should we? There's no truth. There are only private perspectives. I have mine. I have nothing to learn from you, finally, except what your prejudices are. And why should I care about your prejudices unless I happen to be your psychoanalyst, which I'm not. So, well, now, this attitude, which I find filtering down into or up into or maybe filtering out from, but I find this attitude increasingly common in the university scene today. I would say this attitude is not yet influential in the physical sciences, though it is creeping in even there. It has become fairly influential indeed in the social sciences. And in the area of ethics and politics, it has acquired the status of a dogma. And humanities is probably somewhere between social sciences and ethics and politics. In these areas, now particularly I'm going to focus on the last one, ethics and politics. When you discuss ethics and politics today, the objective nature of the truth that you seek is flatly denied. And reason has been dismissed from these areas as mere rationalization. You see, ethics and politics, here you're talking about value judgments. And values are mere subjective preferences. The distinction between good and evil is finally just personal prejudice. We have become what I like to call absolute relativists when we talk about ethics and politics. We are absolute relativists. But the values of a university, which I think are also the fundamental values of a liberal democratic society, small l, small d, the kind of society that we long had and cherished in this country, the liberal democratic tradition, which includes its basic premises, these values, demands that we be not absolute relativists, but kind of relative absolutists. Well, let me put it this way. We are today increasingly becoming relativists in principle. In principle, we say everything is relative. And as a corollary and consequence, I want to argue, we have become absolutists in practice. We've become the most dogmatic kind of absolutists when the chips are down, precisely because we are relativists in principle. But the liberal democratic tradition demands that we be absolutists in principle so that we can be relativists in practice. Well, why would these pairs be found associated in this peculiar way? Because it seems to me that if you maintain that there's no possibility of assessing the truth with regard to ethical or political judgments, and that reasons that people give, you know, are merely rationalizations, then when opinions differ, we can ignore the differences if they don't matter. You know, if it's possible to say, oh, you go your way and I'll go my way. If that's possible, we can do that. But if the opinions do matter, then we have to submit them to the test of force. That's all we can do, after all. Because, you know, there's nothing to discuss. And there's really no one to discuss. You're just expressing your prejudices and I'm expressing mine. And how can we get together, rationally talk it out, and come through with a rational decision? What's the evidence to which we look? You just look inside your guts and I look inside mine, and we don't get anywhere that way. So suppose I feel strongly then that a certain policy is unjust. But I maintain, of course, this is just a value judgment, meaning this is just the way I feel, you know. This is my prejudice, it happens to be the way I was brought up. It's my nutty hang-up. It's my taste, my personal preference. I really feel strongly about it, but it's just my hang-up. Then what can I do if I feel strongly except fight? I marshal all the force I can to put down opposing views so that my hang-up wins the day. You know, de gustibus non disputandum. There's no disputing tastes. And if value judgments in the area of politics are mere tastes, then there's no disputing them. So let's fight. Of course, there's another alternative. Say, well, I don't give a damn. I feel strongly about it, but it is a hang-up, so forget it. So we vacillate, it seems to me, and I just see this happening on the campus. I wish people would not be so impressed with only the student revolt. The students are out protesting. I wish they would see the other aspect of the revolt. The students who are sitting in their fraternities in massive indifference to anything, including the whole educational process. So we vacillate between apathy and violence, between no action and direct action. Between indifference and coercion, between the abandonment of political life in privatism, and as you get out of college, it becomes suburban privatism. You go out to the suburb and you just forget the whole thing. Oh, it's math. We vacillate between that and the abandonment of democratic political life through techniques of rule or ruin. And I think this follows from a kind of relativism in principle. But now, if you are an absolutist in principle, if you affirm the essential rationality of the man with whom you disagree, and your own, then you say, what I believe to be just may turn out, after I've talked it out very thoroughly with you and we've looked at all of the evidence around here, may turn out not to be really just, but at the moment, I believe it really is. And when I say this is a just policy, I'm asserting something about the way people get along together in the world, the way she runs. I'm making some statements about I'm making a utilitarian statement here, and utilitarian statements can be assessed by their consequences. So I then enter into dialogue with you, with those who disagree, to show these people that this is so, that this really would be a just law, and why it's so, and how it's so. Moreover, I listen to them. It's a dialogue, not a monologue, so that my own discernments can be corrected and made more adequate. If I believe that ethical and moral judgments are judgments about reality, in logically the same sense that scientific judgments are judgments about reality, this would be a just law, is logically the same kind of statement as this material is salty. And I think it turns out to be logically the same, although I sure don't want to get into that now. I'd love to get into it with Bill or somebody back there. But I think that it is. But anyway, if we maintain, and that's what I mean by being an absolutist in principle, maintain that these important judgments that we make in the area of politics and ethics are judgments about reality, and they're not just, you know, arbitrary things, you know, and everybody's got his own, and what difference does it make because there's no reality that corrects it or sits in judgment on them, then I think it becomes possible to be a relativist in practice. You know, then you can say, well, reality will judge, so I don't, you know, I'm not the only one defending my cause. It's like the law of gravity. You don't feel defensive about it. If somebody says, I reject the law of gravity, you don't feel you got to go out and fight. You feel, well, buddy, events will catch up with you. If you are this kind of absolutist in principle and relativist in practice, I think you reject apathy and no action and indifference and privatism. Because the real world makes demands upon you. The way in which reality always does contain imperatives. The kid is hungry, and you gotta feed him. And there are imperatives in that. And they come to you through the way he screams if he's hungry. And you can tell it if you just pay attention to reality. On the other hand, you reject violence and direct action and coercion and the philosophy of rule or ruin, because you know that you haven't seen everything that there is to be seen. So, I'm suggesting that if we can recapture this faith, which interestingly is the creed of the university and the basic premises of the liberal democratic tradition, we can find a human, rational course between these extremes of apathy on the one hand and violence on the other, which I think are increasingly coming to be the preferred options of people in our society. Well, what would it mean and how would it work out in practice? Let me take the phenomenon of civil disobedience, which the student revolt is. Student revolts are a form of civil disobedience. Let me just look at this phenomenon for a moment and ask what this tradition says about civil disobedience. In debates over civil disobedience, you always get two positions. On the one hand, you get people saying, you've got to obey the law, always obey the law. You can't just run around and decide which laws you want to mean. Oh, law and order will collapse. St. Paul says, be obedient to the powers that be, and so forth. On the other hand, you have people say, no, you must disobey an unjust law. Well, now, I don't think either of these options is really tenable. Who of us really believes that you have to obey any law? You know, we say, but you must obey God rather than man. And that implies that there's some point at which you stop obeying the law. So to say you must obey all the laws, we don't really believe that. But what about the guy who says, well, you just obey the just laws or you disobey an unjust law? The problem is, who decides what an unjust law is? Individual conscience? This turns out to be anarchy. After all, we know what rationalizers we can be. There are people in our society who say the income tax is unjust. There are people who say open occupancy laws are unjust. You can find some nut in our society to say that almost any law is unjust. Are we going to concede to every individual the right to disobey every law that he, in the privacy of his heart, condemns as unjust. And that way, indeed, lies anarchy. The state cannot grant this right to anybody. And a political philosophy which concedes to every individual the right to sit in judgment in the privacy of his conscience upon every law, concedes this right to him, is inviting anarchy and will not be able to sustain itself. Well, if neither of these positions is tenable, is there a tenable position? I think there's a third position. It says, of course you obey the law, for all the obvious reasons, even when you don't agree, until it becomes your duty to disobey. Now you say, what's the difference? What's the difference between duty and conscience? A great deal. Duty implies an obligation toward something outside of yourself. Duty implies an obligation to some external reality. Most immediately, in the case of civil disobedience, it implies obligations to all of the other people in your society. Obligations to the Constitution, to the institutions of your society. When you say, I disobey this law because it is my duty, you say, there is something out there that imposes upon me a demand that says, I must not. So what? So this. Then those about you can say, what is that that makes these demands upon you? Explain yourself to us. Tell us why you refuse to obey this law. And we begin the process of political discourse, dialogue, which is the same process to which a university is committed. The Declaration of Independence does not appeal to private conscience. It doesn't say, we deep in our hearts, each of us individually decided to revolt against the king. It said, some terrible things have happened. And so we have decided to separate ourselves off. And whenever a people decides to do this, a decent respect for the opinions of mankind requires that they declare the causes which impel them to the separation, that they give the reasons for their action, that they explain themselves. Martin Luther King, whose strategy was so thoroughly consistent, I feel, with the liberal democratic tradition and so tragically misinterpreted by his friends and his foes, Martin Luther King was, I think, the articulate spokesman, the only one left, really, in the public eye for this tradition. And that is one of the great tragedies of his death. His friends and his foes have done badly by him. His friends say that Martin Luther King asserted the Christian conscience. He put the Christian conscience over law. He did no such thing. And his foes, you notice, say much the same thing. They say, who is this man? He thinks he can set himself above the law. What is the difference between saying, I set my Christian conscience above the law, and saying, I set myself above the law? I don't think there is much difference. But Martin Luther King didn't do either one of these things. Martin Luther King called for discussion. And he used every device short of disobedience to secure discussion of what he maintained were unjust laws. Because he said, you people out there are rational. You're looking at the same reality I'm looking at. You see how Negroes live and how whites live. You're familiar with our history. My friends, let's sit down and talk together, and let me point some things out to you that you're not noticing, that you're not paying attention to. The only way I can get through to you and get you to see what I'm seeing and what my people are seeing is for you to engage me in dialogue. And very often, people would not do it. The relevant people wouldn't talk with him. They wouldn't negotiate. They wouldn't discuss. And so Martin Luther King finally would say, if you do not discuss, I must simply disobey and thereby carry the discussion to a new level. He would sort of confront us with an act that compelled us to begin talking. If only, what are we going to do with this guy? I would invite you to consider, to look closely at the actual strategies that Martin Luther King used in all of the cities where he worked. It is so obvious. He would first announce his goals, announce his readiness to discuss, and then they'd say, we are going to march until so-and-so sits down and talks with us. Here's what we want to talk about. And he always talked. He was always open to those who would discuss with him. Because Martin Luther King did not believe that he had a right to set himself above the law, but because Martin Luther King was committed to his own humanity and the humanity of all of the people about him. He believed that white racists were human beings. Well, I should have hoped that universities, which are themselves essentially committed to the liberal democratic tradition, would be stalwartly defending and supporting it in this day when it's not very widely supported and defended. But unfortunately, the universities have not taught it to the students. It is the better students who are today rejecting the liberal democratic tradition on the side of violence, direct action, coercion, rule, or ruin. Well, of course, the majority of the rest reject it on the side of apathy, no action, indifference, privatism. But we are not teaching it. And even the younger faculty apparently have not learned this tradition. That really deeply disturbs me. The instructors and the assistant professors in so many of our major university campuses seem, they never have heard of it. Never have heard of the liberal democratic tradition. I'm just dumbfounded. They've never read or thought about John Locke or Lord Acton or John Stuart Mill or... I should be careful in naming them. I indicate my prejudices, or Thomas Jefferson or... all the great people and... So, as a result, these people are fouling their own nest. They're denying in practice the presuppositions that are undergirding their own activity. They are destroying academic freedom in the name of academic freedom. And I'm afraid that the chickens will come home to roost. I've had enough pigeons. Now, I want to just ask the question at the end. Is all of this disrespect for the liberal democratic tradition, this sort of not so much outright rejection as dismissal as irrelevant of these values, is this a part of what José Ortega y Gasset has called the revolt of the masses? And I'm afraid it shows most of the symptoms. As you read through this little book, Revolt of the Masses, you find all kinds of things that Ortega says are characteristic of the revolt of the masses. Disrespect for history. What can you learn from history? This is a new, this is a new era, this statement. We live in a revolutionary age. We can't learn anything from the past. Everything's different. Many things are different, but you have to go to the past to find out what is different and why it's different. Rejection of discipline, including disciplined inquiry. I had a student who did more than a term paper, it was an independent study semester, and he was doing a paper on advertising. And he was going to blast the advertising profession. And I tried to, feed him all kinds of material. Of course, I realized in the process of studying it, he would learn that though there were many, many evils there, there were a few things that weren't as bad as he painted them. He was going to really get a more accurate understanding. He came in with just a blast. He hadn't read any of the books on advertising that I'd recommended to him. He just read two papers by two firm critics of advertising, neither of whom knows too much about it in detail. And out of this, he had just built a... And he was blasting advertising for everything that had gone wrong in our society. Advertising was responsible for the Vietnam War, violence in the cities, the breakup of the home, really. And I said, well, what are you doing here? I said, how can you say advertising is responsible? He said, well, advertising is a symbol. I said, well, symbol of what? A symbol of everything that's going wrong in our society. I said, well, look, what, but define your terms. And I started going through the paper. I said, is this true? What do you mean here? He said, look, you're talking about analysis, but the times are late. We have no time for analysis. We must act. I never persuaded him. He got an F finally. He's a good kid. I love him. I've had him over my home. We are good friends, but I finally had to give him an F. He would not do it. He intended to, but the semester got late, and he finally said, he got a D in the course because he'd done good work for the other stuff. But here was, there is, the times are dangerous. There's no time to think. Study, no time to study, let's act. Ortega talks about the fascination with technique and little concern for the substance of technique as being characteristic of the revolt of the masses. And gee, you see this in university campuses, especially in the social sciences, where we've become masterful at the measurement of the trivial because it is measurable. Radical ingratitude, he talks about. Rejection of all limitations, the barbarism of specialization, the rise of what he calls the spoiled masses, who are unintelligent enough to believe that the material and social organization placed at their disposition like the air is of the same origin. And open hostility toward liberal democracy. The students on some of our campuses who call themselves Leninists and Maoists, they are saying liberal democracy stinks. You can't have government by discussion, by political discourse. It doesn't work. You must put us in charge. We who are the good men, put us in charge and we will create the good society. There's nothing wrong with Johnson, except that he just didn't happen to be a good man. But he was right, you know, that's the way you do it. You ramrod it through, you deceive and conceal, and oh, I better be careful here, but you know, I mean, the image of Johnson as the great operator, that's an image I think many of our students really accept. The only thing they have wrong with Johnson wasn't on the right camp, that's all. He wasn't a good guy, but I am a good guy. Elect me. Ortega says, and I think this applies to so many of our students, whom I'm not criticizing them personally. I am fond of these people. But I think they've been badly served by the presuppositions of our age and by the universities who failed to teach them. These students want to destroy our whole social system because it has faults. And as I see them, you know, coming in, talking, preaching the revolution, and then jumping in their Mustangs, I thought of Ortega's, this thing go. The new man wants his motor car and enjoys it, but he believes that it is the spontaneous fruit of an Edenic tree. In the depths of his soul, he is unaware of the artificial, almost incredible character of civilization and does not extend his enthusiasm for the instruments to the principles which make them possible. And I think that's all of us who've gotten so used to just pulling the chain and having the toilet flush. I don't know why I choose a scatological metaphor. Maybe it has some profound theological significance.
And for our argument, I'd like to turn the term around a little bit and give us conservatives a chance to call it a radical conservative dynamic instead of a liberal democratic.
Oh, what Carol, yeah, that's...
The point to meet yours and being the cult of modernity, and two, the discipline of an elite, and three, a dynamic remnant, an expanding remnant. Now, this is where I see what we're doing. Obviously, the church doesn't want it because there hasn't been a parish one. 5% of the parish are ready for it, there ought to be places where they can be and get 10% of the parish involved, see when they get back. On this sort of thing, might be cold modernity, this fad or the fashion to prevail, you know, without any discipline over against the tradition and so on. This is right to be radical conservative value. This is why I was just turn around by I thought of the novel, which I like the last deliverable that he's always experimenting on. And I'm tired of being experimental.
Well, I'm just using the word liberal here in a sort of more of a 90s. Yeah, so that today I find, in fact, when this position is put forward today, people usually say that's a conservative position. And as one person told me yesterday, I'm a dinosaur for espousing that.